This episode of Revision Path is brought to you by Facebook Design. You've heard of Facebook, right? Huge site, over a billion people visit it every day. But what's it like working there? I talked with this week's guest, product designer John Angelo, to find out.
The most interesting thing about working at Facebook is just having a wide, diverse group of people and experts all together in one very centric mission of, like, you know, connecting the world's people and making it easy to communicate with each other and, you know, and bringing the world, you know, making the huge world feel close together. This is my first time really working at a company in that sense that has such a united theme or mission with so many different components and experts working toward that exact same mission.
Learn more at facebook.com/design. Are you looking for a job? Do you know someone who's looking for a job? Then check out our job board over at revisionpath.com/jobs. Whether you want a full-time job or you're looking for something temporary or freelance, we've got you covered. This week, Little Bird Innovation is looking for a design associate for their Memphis office. We also have job listings from Indeed.com, so head to the Revision Path job board at revisionpath.com/jobs to apply and to search for any other listings. Don't forget to sign up for our weekly job alert, so when there are new positions added to the job board, you'll get an email so you can be the first to apply. And if you're looking for more jobs, then become a member of our Slack community and join the jobs channel. See you there.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and before we get into this week's interview, let's talk about our sponsors, MailChimp and Hover. More than 10 million businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters. No other email service provider is better when it comes to both functionality as well as customer service. Sign up for a free account today at MailChimp.com. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it. That's where Hover comes in. Hover makes it super easy for you to find the domain name that you're looking for and get it up and running with no hassle and no heavy-handed upselling. So go ahead and grab yourself a domain today and use our promo code REVISIONPATH and you'll save 10% off your purchase. Speaking of saving money, we've got another sale going on in our store this week. So starting on Thanksgiving, you'll be able to save 15% off everything in our store and get free shipping when you use the promo code 2016OMG. That's 2016OMG. I'll have a link in the show notes for that also. And a little birdie told me that there may be some new designs in the store just for this sale, so you might want to really check that out. Again, 15% off plus free shipping. Offer ends on November 28th. Here's our Patreon fundraising campaign update. So we're up to 40 patrons, which is a new patron record, for a new total of $266 per month. Again, thanks to all of you who have pledged your support and your appreciation for the show. It really means a lot, really helps keep things going here on a regular basis. If you enjoy what we're doing here at Revision Path, if you enjoy the guests that we have on the show, or if you've gotten any value from listening to the interviews, please consider becoming a patron. You'll get some great perks like early access to future episodes, free Revision Path goodies, as well as access to our patrons-only podcast. So just head on over to patreon.com/revisionpath and make that happen. Pledge levels start at just $1 a month, and it's a great and affordable way to support the show on a regular basis. Now let's get on to this week's interview. Our month of interviews at Facebook headquarters continues, and this week's guest is product designer John Angelo. Let's start the show. All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is John Angelo, and I'm a product designer at Facebook. I lead the news product, the Facebook news product. And before that, I worked at YouTube under Google and led a couple of design efforts there, ranging from a variety of different video immersion related topics. And my specialty is interaction design, particularly in bringing emotion into design and basically, you know, creating happy emotions in the products that you're using. it sometimes will vary from one end to the other end of the scale, and that sometimes his mission is getting people on and off an application as quickly as possible, getting them the content they want and allowing them to jump off, efficiency basically. And then the other end of the spectrum is keeping people on an application and making them enjoy that experience and wanting to be on it as much as possible. So those are things I focus on, and my passion in this is just making people happy through their experiences.
So we'll go more into, of course, what you did at Google and YouTube, and of course, about interaction design. Let's talk a little bit about, at least what you can talk about, your work that you're doing at Facebook. So you're working with Facebook News, is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Did you choose to work with that department?
Yes, definitely. That Facebook News is the reason I came over to Facebook. It's my favorite topic or genre of apps and features. And I'm a news junkie myself on my app right now. I'm sorry, on my phone right now. I have at least 40 applications that relate to news. I'm a regular news junkie. However, despite that, I have not come across too many, if any, really perfected or, you know, no real sense of perfection ever really, but a news app that I'd rate a 10 exactly. And so since, you know, there's a lot to be desired from news in general, not just in the app space itself, but sometimes in the way it's presented in an article, I felt it was a great opportunity to do something that I would enjoy, one, and something that I feel could make a huge impact in terms of informing the world in a way that, you know, might be interesting. For example, you know, I didn't want to just tell people a story. I wanted to put people into a story. And that's kind of where I've been centering my efforts into a complete story immersion to get people to feel what events are like. Let's say it's a protest going on in Charlotte. Put people in that protest. Make them feel the news as opposed to just reading about it.
So you have over 40 news apps on your phone, which is a lot. So because of that, I'm sure you know, or you've had a lot of interactions, I should say, with these apps and things. What is it that you like and what is it that you don't like about news apps?
Yeah. So for one, it's discoverability. It's something that is a challenge a lot of times. Occasionally an app will, you know, make the, you know, great experience of, you know, helping, allowing the user to pick what sources and topics they want to read. But, you know, after that, sometimes things may get lost. Let's say the picker might be like, oh, are you into fashion? And then you get a little bit too much fashion to the point where it's like, oh, this is overload. And, you know, and then in term, and also the ability to just give you digestible chunks of things. Sometimes you don't really have the time in your day to, you know, to read an entire article, or, you know, you just want to experience the application in chunks and get the most out of it. And also things like sentiment experiences that I think are great in these circumstances. And for a lot of people, what they come to articles for in the first place, they want to hear and feel what other people feel about that same topic in the easiest way as possible. And so that and many other things are reasons that I got involved in this project and what inspires me about this particular mission.
So interaction design, for those that are out there that are listening, can you explain just a little bit about what it is?
Yes, I could do that all day. But interaction design is basically how an experience feels as you're using it. It's not always about aesthetics. You know, I tell people I'm a designer, I'll say, oh, what are you designing? Do you do a YouTube logo? What do you know in the past and whatnot? And even people inside the industry will often confuse interaction design with motion design. But no, interaction design is basically what the experience is like from a flow-to-flow basis. Basically, as you open up an app or anything, even if you're interacting with a door. You know, the interaction of like, you know, the push and pull affordance, basically this notion of affordances and, you know, how you access or do something on an experience. And so interaction design is centered around just making something feel well as you're using it.
And what about that in particular got you interested? I mean, there's so many different types of design.
Yeah, it started from frustration, really. One of my earlier moments, I always try to pinpoint to what started getting the interaction design gears flowing in my mind. And I was thinking about this actually on the way to meet with you. I think my earliest experience of it was with my switch in the 90s from Mac to Windows. I don't want to, you know, I love Microsoft for different reasons, for lots of different products. But, you know, going from, you know, at that time, my family Mac, I remember my dad brought in a Compact. And so my first experience with Windows was Windows 95. I remember having lots of frustrations. Mm-hmm. It's like, why does this not feel well? You know, a lot of it, it too can be, you know, brought into like, you know, you learn computing a certain way and, you know, you have to like, you know, deviate to a different method. But some were legitimate issues, you know, and usability that I felt weren't being really focused on and on that particular platform at the time. And, it was frustrations like that got me into it. Another one that I can point to is video gaming. I'm, more thin than now, but a hardcore gamer. And, every time I get frustrated, and usually where I get frustrated in video games is in the setup process when you're just trying to get to the game, you know, and I feel like this is something that's actually still spiraling the wrong way. Like you open up your Xbox, you know, to play a game, and like, you know, 5 hours later, you might be playing a game after like updating and, mm-hmm. you know, and like navigating through, constantly changing set of patterns. And it always just harken to the old days where you just pop in the game and it's like, start, you know, yeah, and I'm not playing, you know.
It's so rare that happens now.
Yeah, very rare that it happens. And so it's just frustration points with that made me start thinking about it. So it's like, why is it so good? And identifying companies who are doing a great job at it. At the time, to me, it was Nintendo. Not perfect, but, you know, at least they, you know, when there wasn't an instant load, they did a great job at conveying emotion to make that experience feel well. So that's what got the gears rolling and got me thinking about interaction design. It just was unfortunate at that particular time in the 90s that the term interaction design, or even to some degree the term UX, wasn't really used. And so I kind of had to force that path a little bit. That one of the hardest decisions I had to make was going into college about what I want to major in, because I started designing very early. I started programming, taught myself how to program back in high school. But I wanted something that could like help me learn more about the mission I wanted in design, which is helping people enjoy things a little bit better. And so, you know, then it was like, okay, should I go into psychology? I veered into cultural anthropology. Those experiences helped, you know, form my entry into this field. And then I was just delighted to, you know, see the growth in the field over the early 2000s, especially after the iPhone came out. It just became incredible from there.
And now let's talk a little bit about some of your early days. Again, we're going to get to talking about Google and YouTube, of course, but your early days, you were a military kid, so you grew up kind of all over the world. Where mm-hmm. where did you live?
Yeah. I was born in Gary, Indiana. Yeah. Woohoo! And when I was 5 years old, my family moved to Japan, which I spent the majority of our time, particularly Okinawa, Japan. I live in Okinawa. We would leave and spend time since in North Carolina, where I live in North Carolina. And then we go back to Okinawa again, and then we go back to North Carolina again, and then we go back to Okinawa again. But it's a lot of those two places. And then I also studied in Italy, and then I started missing Japan a whole lot, which is strange because there was a time when I was growing up in Japan where I just wanted to be off the island of Okinawa. I like Okinawa, but it's a very tiny place, and you get that island fever where you just want to leave. And then I remember going to study cultural anthropology and international relations in Italy, and just missing Japan so much and wanted to get back there and complete my studies there. And then from there, I launched into Washington, D.C., started my official career. Post-college career in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., and then to the West.
And now were you doing UX work in D.C.?
Yes. Yes, I was. Yeah, no. In the earlier days, it wasn't really classified as UX work. I started off as an e-learning designer, designing e-learning modules. That phased into being a user interface engineer, I believe was the title, or user interface developer. And then within a matter of a few years, the UX industry got big and prominent in that sense and terminology. Still, you know, it was a little slow while I was in D.C., but, you know, at least the term came about where I can actually really do, you know, use the full gamut of things I wanted to do to build, you know, the way I, you know, felt was, you know, effective for users.
From there, when did you first get your start at YouTube?
So I started YouTube. It was a long path. It started off my first recruiting by Google back in 2006 or 7. I think it might have been 2007 where the suggestion came about. And, I was as much as I wanted to be in California, I was reluctant because of, you know, relationship. that I'm in, of leaving DC for that reason. So I, you know, kind of held back for a few years. And then finally, after coming to California for a different reason to work for Autodesk, the company came back at me about certain, you know, things. I did a lot of blogging at that particular time about user experience and how to create great video experiences, and was working a lot in that at Autodesk. They came and mentioned the position and what they had in mind for the role, and I ended up joining after all those years of talking to them. And so it was great because YouTube was my favorite product, like literally in technology. Because I learned so much myself from YouTube, and that was my community. As I was telling you, I didn't really have a community, design community, in the early half of my career, especially not growing up. I worked independently a lot. So when I learned a lot, or when I was inspired a lot, or when I did my lectures in those early times, those via YouTube, at least after 2006. And so I love the mission. And so I ended up joining and working on products that kind of helped expand the notion of, allowing people to experience things from wherever.
So you're, like I said, military brat, kind of grew up, you know, different parts around the country. Do you feel like those different experiences, not around the country, around the world, I should say, do you feel like those different experiences really shaped you
majorly,
as a designer?
Majorly.
How so?
Yeah, majorly. The greatest blessing that the military lifestyle provided, which I didn't realize growing up, until like way later on, it was somewhere around college where I started realizing this, was the learning from lots of different perspectives. And it just so happened that the countries that I primarily, was in and lived in were like, couldn't possibly be any more different than each other, States to Japan, and Italy being somewhere in between, and certain aspects of the culture. It helped me to appreciate and learn to talk to people about their cultures and learn from them. And with design, I am able to gain and use those perspectives to create more universal centric designs. Just the design culture in general in Japan was, let's say back to my early years, and the website years were very different. I mean, if you notice, your average Japanese site is very textual based, and, imagery and a lot of the visual gimmicks, and I hate to use the word gimmick, but like, visual marketing techniques and whatnot that are used in a lot of Western sites aren't really used there, or at least not at that time. So it gave a different perspective, a perspective of design that was centered around information architecture. That was very pivotal to a lot of those interfaces I was designing, especially in government, everywhere really, but especially in government at that particular time. So and then Italy gave me a totally different design perspective than even Japan, and probably I learned the most during that particular part of time, and that's when I started being in a major way inspired by things beyond just graphical design, industrial design and fashion and things of that sort, and being able to harness those different types of design into UX design.
Do you have a specific philosophy as a designer?
Yes. Make people enjoy what they're using. Is the biggest thing. And it sounds so basic. It is very basic, but it's one of those things that I feel gets doesn't get as much attention as it should. You'll often see a lot of beautiful, aesthetically beautiful interfaces that don't really, draw any emotion of happiness. And it's just like, oh, this is nice. And they don't end up really lasting or being, in the mindset of your average user, because it's just like, this isn't doing anything for me. This isn't stirring any emotion. This isn't, making me happy. This isn't, putting me in the mood of what I opened up this application to do. And so my mantra is, in addition to minimalism, because I'm a big fan and student of Theodore Ahms, conveying as much emotion as possible in your designs, making people really enjoy what they're on. And I think that goes a long way. These days, your average, user, mobile phones are using less than 10 applications on their phones, whereas it's hard to detach from that being, in a techie world. Sometimes we're getting to that mind state, and that, like me personally, I just check my about menu and my and settings, and I have 980 applications on my phone.
Jesus.
Yeah. At some point, my phone's going to give up on me and just be like, no,
wow.
No more. But 980 applications. So, it's far removed than the average situation. And people choose a small set of applications and stick with them. So you got to, you know, make experiences that people come to, when it comes to regularly, people don't toss aside and, you know, and more importantly, come to you on a day-to-day basis, you know, creating habits out of it. And that, in my opinion, can only really be done by tapping into their emotions.
Now, when you say kind of tapping into your emotions, does part of that sort of involve psychology or how does that really work when you're trying to do it? Is it, do you use color theory or talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so almost all of it involves psychology, color theory, factoring in, but more so interaction psychology in terms of, you know, doing the little tiny things to make you happy. Like, let's say, for example, the new Facebook reactions where, you know, you have this ongoing desire from people for years. Like, oh, I wish there was a dislike button on Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, wish there, you know, there are other ways to convey, you know, respond to things outside of commenting and liking. And, you know, and things like reactions creates that emotion. Like, we're going to give you more than what you asked for. We're going to give you liking or the ability to laugh or the ability to, you know, to cry or to, you know, express, you know, anger, but in a way that, for one, that makes you feel good, you know, and doesn't make other people feel good in that process. There's just so many great ways through interaction to interaction design to do that sort of thing. Or even the tiniest things like, okay, it's your birthday today on an application, so you're raining down confetti. It makes you feel good. Mm-hmm. Through things that, like, you know, by the book, you know, or by technicality may be ignored if you're just following very specific objectives, you know, driven down to you. But when you add those little tiny elements of psychology into your design, it creates that allegiance and that happy feeling that makes people want to come back the next day. It makes people feel that you're not just dealing with a machine, you're dealing with like a personal assistant of sorts. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way, in my opinion, to design well from an interaction standpoint, is to pretend that what you're designing is a person that's going to be working with the person that, you know, is using the application. You know, create something that's effective and connects with the person, not just as, you know, in a butler type of way all the time, but, you know, sometimes in a friend type of way. It's like, okay, we're helping each other.
What do you think a designer really needs to know in 2016, this year, to be successful? It can be certain soft skills, certain hard skills, et cetera.
Yeah. In terms of hard skills, prototyping. Prototyping is the big thing, and not being intimidated by the word prototyping, because every, you know, time I bring this up and I try to teach this, people are like, oh my God, the notion of code just scares me. And you know, it's not even necessary, really, you know, coding and the type of prototyping I'm conveying. Prototyping, especially when you're working with developers, to convey what you're trying to express and that, you know, in ways that static mocks just can't do. You can use any application that, you know, that doesn't involve coding if coding is intimidating. By that sense, and oftentimes is frankly not even really needed. The biggest examples of, you know, code-centric prototyping apps like, you know, Framer and whatnot, while great, I use it personally and I enjoy it, is, you know, you can do those, a lot of those same things enough to convey your meaning in ones like Plinto or Principle or Hype or Endless or even Keynote, you know, just prototyping it, because, you know, especially in this mobile world, it's always easier to express, you know, or even, you know, to developers or even to yourself, you know, the experience you're trying to create if you're, you know, using a living, breathing element to do so.
So what tools do you use?
Oh, a ton. I go back and forth, but primarily I'd say my tools of choice for just raw design is Sketch. Plinto is a favorite. Hype was a favorite for a couple of years now. While working at YouTube, I use Hype like crazy, mostly because of the video capabilities of it and whatnot. Origami. And I do a lot of coding still. Like, I started my earlier years as more of a user experience engineer by just the way the industry was at that particular time. There weren't a lot of just core, you know, UX designers at the time. So I kind of felt I had to learn to harness both of those things together as more of a front end engineer of sorts to survive during that particular era. But so I still code by force of habit sometimes. There are oftentimes where I'll, you know, try to dive in and actually, you know, do that as my way to kind of, for one, convey the meaning, and two, kind of help out the development team in situations, you know, where it's, you know, helpful.
And do they appreciate that? I know sometimes dev and design teams can kind of be a little standoffish.
In my experience, always. Always. No, the reverse isn't always appreciated, but from some designers when devs step in and, you know, give a lot of, you know, forceful design critique. And I do wish the culture of design was, you know, was a little bit more flexible to that, you know, to hearing those out, because, you know, just like, you know, the people that you're interviewing in user interviews, developers, you know, have, you know, a great insights into what you're doing. But no, and from my experience with working with developers, developers have always, I've never had a developer say, wow, you did all this coding for me. I don't like this. No, it's usually greeted very well. I can't really think of a single circumstance where it hasn't. It's, you know, it's been helpful. Sometimes it's great to be that middleman in between your design and development to help you like implement exactly, you know, what you design and, you know, into code. And that's always been my biggest pet peeve, is designing this incredible experience and not just really working out that well when it's developed and coded. So sometimes that can work as a great in between, depending on the structure of the organization or the amount of resources you have available in the UX engineering space.
How do you approach a new project? Like, say, doesn't necessarily have to be something for Facebook, but if it's a new project you're working on, what do you do to kind of get in the swing of it? What do you do to
prepare? I love that question. Yeah. So I am a big fan of the competitive analysis. And this is actually how I learned. So it's a force of habit of how I learned. I learned how to design by looking and finding the best example of whatever it is, like the absolute best example, and then building off of it. For example, let's say, you know, people, actually average person, what's the best, like, you know, mobile OS and, don't want to add any biases, but I mean, I'm guessing most people would probably say iOS. So, like, you know, what is iOS? iOS is a broad example. Maybe I should use something a little bit more or more small, but like whatever it is. Let's say, you know, what is the best sports experience? And the person says Bleacher Report. You know, and it's like, okay, I'm going to take a look at, you know, what I come in to do is to take a look at why people like Bleacher Report, by asking them, by, you know, reading reviews, and also why people, you know, what tiny things people might have with Bleacher Report. So starting from what people consider to be the best in that particular topic, and just adding every single issue they have to it, and to the point where you pull from lots of different competitors the best of them and assimilate it into something that's awesome, and then add your own magic over top, add your own emotional experience over top, which is something that nearly no one does really in a major way. And then from, you know, to me, that's a great starting point. So I draw a lot from competitive analysis and then most importantly, talking to users along this process. And I incorporate those two things together. I very rarely actually do the competitive analysis these days by myself. I typically will just, like, you know, do a focus group or some sort of a user research mechanism to see what people think about those, you know, those top apps and hear from them directly, you know, what they like about it and what they don't like about it, and use that feedback to create the best thing possible.
Are there any other, like, designers or artists out there that you really admire, that you look up to?
Yes. Touched to my design style, I have to say Dieter Rams is probably the most influential. His 10 principles. Johnny Ive is an obvious one of a designer that I like. I love Mateus Duarte. His WebOS design just inspired so much for me in terms of patterns and, you know, magic, emotion, inspiration, you know, when making the transition from to learning, you know, mobile design, and many others, Mike Mattis and lots of people outside of, you know, user interface design, and even figures that don't really, you know, traditional figures in design, like, I mean, you know, like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, and even things that, you know, Steve Jobs have said over time, you know, just people who are design and product people minded in the way they think about what they build. Those are people that kind of stand out to me and help me drive my own design principles at times. You know, people who focus very strongly on making people feel connected to things.
Is there anything in particular that you're excited about at the moment? Like, maybe something you're working on, maybe something in your personal life, anything like that?
I'm excited about the focus that I'm seeing a lot in this area on accessibility. I have a daughter with Down syndrome, and just seeing her interact with applications and just regular, you know, items on a day-to-day, often disappoints me in terms of, you know, the way things are, you know, certain things like aren't designed with disabilities taken into account. And so I'm really excited about the focus that I'm seeing in accessibility and just general universal design that really inspires me. And also I'm very, very excited about augmented reality. Admittedly, not as much about virtual reality, but augmented reality is just something that I spent so many years exploring and fantasizing about in terms of like the hardware to make some of these interfaces that I'd love to build possible. I think that could be the perfect segue to having technology that's not intrusive, but that, actually helps connect us a little bit better in certain ways, and definitely for efficiency. I'm just imagining a world where, you could be walking down the road and instead of trying to, determine what's around a corner, an overlay comes above and tells you what's around a corner, or tells you where the sales are if you're like in a shopping center, or it tells you where the best, shows you the food of restaurants in a particular square, or if you're looking for your friend in the crowd. I remember being at the inauguration a few years ago and not being able to find my friends legitimately because there's so many people, which is a delightful problem. But, that's when I start, imagining this notion of overlays, something to, augmented reality overlay, over top of, life to tell you, okay, your friends are right here. Here, I'm going to guide you directly to them, all the way to, to them, and things like that. So I'm really excited about that. And it seems like it by itself is just launching a new era of something to look forward to in our industry, because I do feel like in some ways we had a little bit of a stalemate in innovation for a few years where things got a little boring in some respects. But I see things ramping up and a lot, and that really excites me overall.
What would you say have kind of been the particular high points of your career? I mean, would you say YouTube is kind of it, or what would you say?
High points of my career. That's a very tough one. YouTube is close. Yeah. YouTube is probably one of my high points. Another one for me is since I started, have been obsessed with this mission of building a great resource for cultures, people to learn about other cultures and language. One of my biggest hobbies is learning languages. I love language. From moving around a lot, I kind of forced myself to dive into that particular world. And I think through understanding language and culture, the world can, it sounds very, very meta a little bit, but the world can, come together a lot mm-hmm. better. I think, understanding, breeds cooperation. And I think a lot of, the world's issues are a result of people just not understanding each other's cultures. And so I've always wanted to build the ultimate tool for understanding culture. One of my career highlight, I don't know if you can call it a career highlight, but at least side project highlight was coming up with a great platform for doing that, or at least a plan to build a platform to do that. I got discouraged a little bit along the way in terms of, for one, it was this notion of, is this the best idea? Is highlighting cultural differences more helpful than this notion that was getting into my ear about blending people together into one? And I was like, later on, no, that's crazy. You definitely want to highlight, but just do it in a way that this makes everyone feel connected. And so That was the highlight, just that ideation phase, even if it didn't result in the startup that I wanted it to be, just the fact that I, just the notion of just talking to people. I became a cultural anthropologist for a bit in terms of talking to people about their cultures and what would help them be interested in other people's cultures. And so that was the highlight, just that experiment in building that particular startup. Set the groundwork to thinking about design in a brand new way, and it benefited even my main career, even in my experiences at Google and Autodesk and in government a whole lot more when I started working on those side projects, which is why I'm always a huge fan of side projects. So my biggest advice from new designers is to do as many as possible. Do the things that you want to do. I was inspired by something you were mentioning or someone else was mentioning in the interview that you did a while back about learning when to say no, to projects, when people ask you to do things. But one thing that I would encourage for one, building your portfolio and just learning yourself is to build a startup, even if you don't intend for it to be the next Facebook or Google or anything like that, mm-hmm. that you enjoy, because you put the best work into things that you personally, applications that you want to do. And, your creativity tends to step up when you're doing things that you're interested in. And so I encourage designers to do that. Work on your own startup, even if you don't really plan on doing too much with it, because it'll bring out the best in you, and hey, it'll look great on your portfolio. It makes for great case studies.
What advice would you give to somebody that's kind of just starting out let's say they want to follow in your footsteps. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to them as a designer?
The advice I would give for someone just starting out would be to, for one, learn as quickly as possible, identify as quickly as possible the best designers and or applications so that you can know where the, you know, so that you can build a standard within yourself. One of the things I did was, you know, I when I started was to seek out who's the best at this craft and how can I be like them? And so I quickly went about, you know, identifying my mentors, who people who I wanted to design like, people who I, you know, products that I enjoy. You know, that's where the Johnny Ive thing stood in for me in terms of I enjoyed his products. I enjoyed the way they looked. I enjoyed the way they felt. And so that, you know, then I began looking up, you know, everything I could about him and learning about his life and all of that and who his influencers were. And, I started learning a lot about, and that actually was the, you know, the gateway to learning more about Dieter Rams and his inspiration, you know, and also like, you know, how, you know, his passion or his, inspiration by Sony or yeah, he was inspired by Sony. Sorry, I said that wrong, but, I identify the best of the best in your field and identify mentors and then also just dive right in. I, throughout my life, one of the biggest challenges, hurdles I had to overcome is my own perfectionism. I would have a paper in front of me, a new notepad, and be afraid to jot something down in it because I wanted to have it all crafted on my brain before I did something. It's just like, I don't know how to even really describe it. It's just like, I want to start working on designing this thing, but I just wanted to have it perfectly crafted in my mind before I even like, you know, put the pen to the paper. But, you know, you just got to do it. You just got to do it. And once you actually start is when you get the most of your best results and iterate. So just dive right in there. Work on anything. Don't wait around for someone to give you an opportunity or to get the first job. Just work on whatever you want to work on and just trial by fire. Just dive right in there and just try it. And also do something that I wish I'd done earlier, which is just like linking up to design communities around you. If, you know, they exist and they should, you know, in most locations, unless you're living like dead smack in the middle of Indiana or something or some, you know, tropical island. But in that case, you know, that's what the internet's for.
What advice has stuck with you the longest?
So the design advice that sticks most with me and kind of drives a lot of my philosophy is one by Alan Cooper, in which he said, if we want users to like our software, we should design it to behave like a likable person. And I think when I first heard that, that quote, it sparked a newness in me, a new way of just approaching, you know, a mode of design. I just immediately start going back to the psychology books and using that, using lessons there to kind of recraft the way I viewed and designed. And so that, you know, that's a major one for me. And I think that one that could be helpful if you keep that in mind as you're designing everything you do.
So walk me through kind of like what a typical day like is for you. If there is a typical day.
Yeah. I can't say that I have a set routine. I always envy designers I come across who have these routines that are so so precise. Wake up in the morning at 7 a.m. and I drink coffee and then I walk outside and watch the sunset or sunrise or whatever, which lets you know I'm not an early riser at all because I'm pretty sure the sunrise is way earlier than that. But no, my typical day is all over the place. But it typically always involves me trying to gain some sort of inspiration via something I'm doing. And, you know, I do drink a lot of tea and I will typically be drinking tea and just staring off into, you know, space. And then my eye will fixate upon something and I start thinking about, I wonder why this was designed that way. And it gets the gears running for the day and, you know, kind of helps me launch in. In terms of throughout the day, I don't do a whole lot of sketching onto paper. Part of this notion of just diving right in is that I typically design over my prototypes. Like I design in, you know, directly into whatever software I'm using for prototyping much of the time these days, just because interaction and emotions and all that, especially with mobile, is so important that I feel like you can't really it's easier to convey the emotion and to design the emotion to things when you're actually just, you know, playing with it on your device itself. It also involves talking to a lot of people, collaborating a whole lot, making sure I'm up a shared vision with PMs and developers and different stakeholders on my team. So I do a lot of collaboration with people, and I do a lot of talking to my friends, and that's really helpful. I typically do like technically a user study every day when it comes to using my friends to gain perspective in their way train of thought when using technology.
So what do you think we can do to kind of get the next generation of designers excited about design? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. For one, efficiency is one. I love that a lot of companies, including ours, and we just recently pushed out a new Facebook design center, are making a lot of their resources and sources available for people to use to help build that efficiency. I think the trends that are going on in our industry with augmented reality and things like that are enough, it's a new space, even virtual reality for people very interested in virtual reality. It's a new space. They're on a lot of like just set patterns and set ways. Whenever there's something new, to me, that's exciting. And being able to be on the forefront of creating something new, using some of the principles learned from other things, applying the ones that work and talking to people and kind of tinkering to determine the new ones that will work for this new technology. I think that's exciting. And I think from a diversity perspective, things like what you're doing with this podcast and this show is just, when I heard about this, is so exciting because I would have loved to have a resource like this growing up. I didn't have any inspirations of my culture to draw from design at all. So things like this and just knowing that this is becoming a very inclusive field that values opinions and differences and leverages all of that to create even better products. I think this next phase of design is just going to be the golden era for sure, because you're going to have lots and different perspectives building it together. And the more perspectives you have and the more diversity you have, the better products inherently become.
Where do you kind of see yourself in the next 5 years? What would you like to be working on?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I've always had this push and pull with myself about how far to dive into management. I want to stay hands-on. I like staying hands-on to things. And even when leadership roles, come about, I try to like maintain as much hands-onness as possible because design is not a job to me. It is like my best hobby, my favorite hobby. Somewhere in between that and, language and karaoke and a couple of other things, but it's a huge hobby for me. I see myself just, working on, next generation, experiences, whatever, I see fit as being the thing that needs the most help. I tend to like to work on things that have problems so that I can fix them and make those experiences better. So if augmented reality, for example, turns out to not be a great experience for a lot of people, see what I can do there to, if I can help, advance that, and a lot of developers in this area and this company in particular are like that. Mm-hmm. I see myself just pushing hard at helping connect the world as much as possible. I see myself pouring out any ideas I had about my culture related projects into this company or other efforts. And most importantly, I find myself working with accessibility a whole lot to help people like my daughter and others also be able to leverage technology as best as possible despite whatever disability they might have. In addition to mentoring others, that's something that I would love to do more, is write more. I've been crafting this book for the longest time now, and I'm like a kind of a self-critic because every stage I am in my career, I'm like, I'm not there yet. I'm not good enough yet. I'm just not good enough yet. I was reluctant to, do things like this because I feel like I'm just not good enough yet. And I realized mm-hmm. I'm like nearly 20 years into like designing as a whole and 10 years professionally. I would like to just finally start getting those ideas collected so that I can be of inspiration to other people. Because, even if you're not, to the level that you want to be, there's so much more help and inspiration you can give to other people and helping pointing them into the direction and helping them, meet their goals and dreams. So that's something that I definitely plan to do as much as possible throughout these next few years and hopefully get into a good groove 5 years from now.
Well, just to kind of wrap things up here, where can our audience find out more about you and about your work online?
Sure, sure. You can find me. My website is johnangelo.com, J-O-H-N-A-N-G-E-L-O.com. I'm on Twitter, johnangelo. And Instagram is just jangelo. And on Facebook, you can look me up, facebook.com/johnangelo.
Sounds good. Well, johnangelo, thank you again so much for taking time out of your day. Thank you for really kind of explaining a lot of what you do behind interaction design, like what that means, why it's important. I can really tell that you're a very thoughtful person behind a lot of this. I mean, you've spent a lot of time explaining a lot of these things, and I think that you're going to have a really good impact here at Facebook. I certainly can tell based on, kind of the work that you've done before that you are really excited and passionate about this. It's not just a job for you. This is something that is really kind of just baked into who you are. So thank you again so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoy what you do. And I look forward to listening to the rest of your episodes for the end of time. Seriously. Thoughts of love are
in your mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to johnangelo, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about John and his work through the links in the show notes at revisionpath.com. Thanks as always to our sponsors, Facebook Design, MailChimp, and Hover. Facebook invests in design. They care deeply about how their design team might do their best work, and that manifests itself in a number of different ways, such as building tools like Origami, sharing what they've learned on Medium, and by giving back to the design community. Learn more about Facebook Design at facebook.com/design. More than 10 million businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters. Attitude may be playful, but their business is serious. Sign up for a free account today. MailChimp. Send better email. Hover takes all the hassle and confusion out of buying and managing your domain names. Just search for a few keywords and Hover will show you the best available options across all the 400 plus domain extensions out there. Ready to get started? Save 10% off your first purchase by using the promo code REVISIONPATH at checkout. This episode was edited by RJ Basilio and produced by me, Maurice Cherry. Our intro voiceover is by Music Man Dre with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. If you like this episode, please do me a huge favor. Leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. It only takes a minute or two. It really helps the show by bumping us up in the iTunes rankings for design podcasts. And I'll even read your review right here on the show. Revision Path is brought to you by Lunch, a multidisciplinary creative studio in Atlanta, Georgia. If you like the work that we're doing with the podcast and with the website, then please visit us over at Patreon and become a patron. Just go to patreon.com/revisionpath and pledge your support. Pledge levels start at just $1 per month, and you'll get access to behind-the-scenes information about the show, upcoming interviews, and so much more. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Happy Thanksgiving.